It was the first time the Soviets had to pay, recalls Hart with passion. We had watched Hungary, we had watched Czechoslovakia, we watched East Germany. Each day we watched the wall. This repulsive, repugnant machine was out there, and we finally found a place where we could get at them. By the time Wilson intervened with his Oerlikon legislation, Hart figured he was riding the most ferocious beast ever to confront communism. Hart thought of himself as facing off against the commander of the Soviet 40th Army in Kabul, and he was so confident of his long-term strategy that he would later boast, "I had him by the balls. I was killing his men, and there was nothing he could do about it." As Hart saw it, every day that the Soviets stayed in Afghanistan with their existing force levels, the United States won. His one consuming fear was that the Soviets would wake up and realize just how much pain the CIA and Zia were exacting, and either withdraw or, more likely, escalate. As Hart saw it, he now had the war on a footing where there was simply no downside to the American involvement. The only thing looming on the horizon that could spoil it all was Wilson. The congressman was on his way back to Pakistan, and Hart decided he had no choice but to go out of channels and somehow try to reason with him. When Wilson arrived in Pakistan in January 1984, Hart was not even on his list of people to see. The congressman was so frustrated with the CIA that he was deliberately making an end run around it. Much to Hart's annoyance, Wilson immediately began a round of private meetings with Akhtar and Zia, who expressed amazement and gratitude for what he and Doc Long had achieved, not just for the $40 million Afghan appropriation, but for saving the entire Pakistan aid program from drastic cuts. "Mr. Wilson, you always surprise me," declared a pleased Zia. Wilson's main reason for coming, however, was to personally bring news to the Afghan rebels of the hind-killing Oerlikons. Professor Mojadedeh had genuinely alarmed him in Washington with his grim accounts of the gunship slaughter. Wilson intended to play the role of cheerleader, talking up the miraculous new weapon in the pipeline to keep Mojadedeh and the other Afghan leaders from losing hope in the months before the Oerlikon and the other weapons could be delivered. It was a mission with noble intentions, but Charlie could never deny himself a bit of pleasure from even the most sensitive of his national security efforts. He had chosen for his traveling companion on this trip a 5'9" Nordic blonde named Cynthia Gale Watson, whom he introduced to everyone as Snowflake. Wilson's practice of always bringing a beautiful woman along on his foreign adventures was far more complicated than just making sure he had a romantic partner in the deserts of Islam. He thirsted for glory and respect, but his lifestyle had left him with a reputation for little more than scandal and excess. All of his remarkable feats of derring do abroad took place in the shadows. No one at home, none of his constituents, not even anyone on his staff, fully understood what a key player he was in the countries where he was now operating. Even his sister Sharon, perhaps the most important person in the world to Charlie, had no idea what he was about. It was only on the junkets when the brass bands came out to greet him and he was received as a statesman in Israel, Egypt, and Pakistan, that the role he was playing in these flashpoints of history became public. But what good was it all without a witness, without someone to tell him how very wonderful he was? Charlie needed a witness to validate the experience, and this time it was Snowflake. Like most of Charlie's loves, she was a beauty queen, the former Miss Northern Hemisphere, a farm girl from Minnesota who could plow a field, break a horse, make her own clothes, and run faster than any woman in the state, and who now, at 28, dreamed of becoming a movie star. Most important, she was a good American girl, filled with enthusiasm and a sense of wonder at this man who was performing miracles, not only for her, but for his country. Snowflake fell into her part effortlessly, weeping over the wounded Mujahideen at the Red Cross Hospital, watching her hero give blood for the freedom fighters, walking arm in arm with Charlie through a sea of refugees as little children sang him their song of the jihad. All of this was just boilerplate for Wilson, who had come to Peshawar to meet with the seven tribes, as he explained to Snowflake. "There are seven ruling leaders. They all banded together to fight this war, and they're coming to meet with me to see if they can get some arms." Snowflake was thrilled when Charlie told her she could sit in on the war meetings. Not wanting to offend the fundamentalist warriors, she went to great lengths to dress conservatively, in a pink nylon jumpsuit with a zipper straight down the front. She even braided her hair and wore combat boots, feeling that a semi-military outfit would put the visitors more at ease. The first of the Mujahideen leaders to arrive in Charlie's room, The engineer Gulbadin Hekmatyar was biblical in appearance, with his long black beard and turban. He was then only 38, but there was a timeless air to him, an almost feline quality, and a gentleness to his manner and speech. Even at that early moment in the war, he awed his fellow Mujahideen as the most ruthless and uncompromising of them all. Gulbadin was the darling of Zia and the Pakistan Intelligence Service. Like other Mujahideen leaders, he had been working with the ISI since the early 1970s, when Pakistan had begun secretly backing fundamentalist students at the University of Kabul who were rebelling against Soviet influence in the Afghan government. Back then, Gulbadin was very much a part of the emerging global wave of Islamic radicalism, opposed to any attempts at altering fundamental tenets of the faith. By all accounts, he was responsible for the practice of throwing acid in the faces of Afghan women who failed to cover themselves properly. The Red Army had a legend of its own about Gulbadin. To the Soviets, he was the bogeyman behind the most unspeakable torture of their captured soldiers. Invariably, his name was invoked with new arrivals to keep them from wandering off base unoccupied, lest they fall into the hands of this depraved fanatic, whose specialty, they claimed, was skinning infidels alive. Gulbadin's reputation would grow to such sinister proportions by the latter part of the war that many U.S. newsmen would almost agree with the Soviets in comparing him to Khomeini and would accuse the CIA of backing the wrong horse. He ran his Hezb-Islami organization like the Communist Party, with utter ruthlessness. Nevertheless, Gulbadin was the freedom fighter, whom Charlie Fawcett and then Joanne Herring had come to know and love when they had made the movie Courage is Our Weapon. And Charlie Wilson was fascinated with him because he had heard that Gulbadin could kill Soviets like no other. Furthermore, Wilson had a specific question for the engineer that he wanted to put to him without the CIA's knowledge. That New Year in Peshawar, into the lobby of the Pearl Intercontinental Hotel swept Gulbadin and his entourage, a tall figure in white with five bodyguards carrying AK-47s. Up to Wilson's suite he strode, the ascetic fundamentalist holy warrior finally coming face to face with his American patron. As if on cue, Cynthia Gale emerged from the congressman's adjoining room in her pink jumpsuit, her hand thrust out in greeting. "Pleased to meet you." What could the engineer possibly have been thinking? By his Muslim standards, Snowflake was half-naked. Whatever his reaction, Gulbadin's face remained neutral, almost benign, as he and the congressman began to talk. "It was just very, very exciting to be in that room with those men with their huge white teeth," remembers Snowflake. "It was very clandestine. There was this secretive feel to it." To her, Gulbadin, as well as all the other Afghans who visited the suite that night, looked on Charlie as the great god that was going to save their lives. This last observation would doubtless have come as a particular surprise to Gulbadin, that disciplined worshipper of Allah, the one and only true god. 7 years later, he would reveal just how much he appreciated all that Charlie and the United States had done for the jihad by siding with Saddam Hussein in the Gulf War. But that evening in Peshawar, sitting with the Texas congressman and his blasphemous traveling companion, Gulbadin was all smiles. Wilson began by telling the commander about the Erlikons and the flood of more and better weapons soon to come. Then he put his question to the engineer. The congressman had certain important contacts with the Israelis, but the CIA was giving him no end of trouble on his proposal to take advantage of a significant opportunity. If Wilson could get the Americans to buy Soviet weapons that the Israelis had captured from the PLO, would Hekmatyar have any trouble accepting them? "We take Russian weapons from dead Russians to use against them. I don't see why we can't take them from the Israelis," replied the engineer wryly. In fact, Gulbadin seemed to have no problem with the origin of any weapons for the jihad. "Allah has many mysterious ways of providing for his faithful," he said. Wilson was delighted. He resolved right then to disregard the CIA's objections and ratchet up his efforts to pressure the agency to buy the PLO weapons and fund the Charlie horse. The next Afghan to find himself face to face with Snowflake that night was Professor Mojadedi, the Mujahideen leader Charlie had taken to meet Bill Casey at the White House. The small professor was surrounded by an even more menacing band of bodyguards than Gulbadin had brought with him. Do they really have to worry that much about the Soviets trying to kill them? Wilson asked a Pakistan ISI man later. It's not the Soviets they're worried about, the man said matter-of-factly. It's each other. They're all trying to keep from being killed by their rivals. Howard Hart would have choked had he witnessed the comic opera of Wilson and Snowflake that evening, singing the praises of the Oerlikons, suggesting to the fundamentalists that they link up with Israel, and then asking that hopelessly naive question about the bodyguards. It would only have confirmed Hart's conviction that Wilson didn't have a clue as to whom he was dealing with.